The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ Senior Attorney Paul, the penultimate warrior Sherman, as well as Evan Burnick of the Center for Judicial Engagement. This week on the show, we'll talk about Paul's favorite things, beer, guns, and the Fourth Amendment. Paul, let's start off with Docs v. Glocks from the 11th Circuit.
Sure. So this case is Wolschlager versus Governor of Florida, and it's an extremely interesting case that involves the intersection of the First Amendment and occupational licensing, which is a truly underexplored area of First Amendment law that the Supreme Court has never weighed in on. The law in this case was passed in Florida a few years ago, and it prohibits doctors from routinely asking their patients whether they own guns. The American Medical Association a few years ago passed a proposal that said that doctors should be gathering this information so that they can give advice to patients on things like gun safety. Now, whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, most people should be able to recognize that that's an exercise of speech, and it should be protected by the First Amendment. But Florida has outlawed it. A group of doctors challenged that law. They won at the district court, and they got up to the Court of Appeals, which now has upheld the law three times under three different rationales. And this most recent decision this week was the third rationale in the case.
And they came to the same conclusion each time. So in their initial decision, the 11th Circuit applied rational basis review. They treated this as not a regulation of speech, but a regulation of professional conduct, applied rational basis review, said it was okay after very perfunctory analysis. Then they took it up again. They vacated the initial decision. They applied intermediate scrutiny. They treated it as speech, but they performed essentially the same perfunctory analysis, came to the same conclusion, and upheld the law again. Now they have, in the wake of a Supreme Court decision in Reed v. Town of Gilbert, revisited the same issue, concluded that this is not only a regulation of speech but a content-based restriction on speech, and applied strict scrutiny. But they came to the same conclusion after performing very perfunctory, deferential analysis, despite the fact that they called it strict scrutiny.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about this case is what passes for strict scrutiny under the majority's analysis. So to satisfy strict scrutiny, the government has to show that a law is narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest. And compelling government interests are very few. These are things like protecting national security, that sort of thing. And so the allegedly compelling government interest in this case is protecting the Second Amendment rights of doctors' patients. Now, the Second Amendment is extremely important. We've supported it here at the Institute for Justice through amicus briefs in the Heller case and the McDonald case in Chicago. But doctors are not capable of infringing patients' Second Amendment rights because doctors are not government actors. They can't take away their patients' guns. And so this law actually doesn't do anything to advance that interest.
Evan, doctors cannot infringe on the Second Amendment, so where is the court coming from here?
It's not entirely clear. There's an attenuated argument about gun owners potentially being chilled in the exercise of their Second Amendment rights as a consequence of being asked intrusive questions by their doctors, which is frankly bizarre. Doctors ask patients intrusive questions all the time about drug use, about sexual relationships, about whether, you know, whether their kids play violent video games. So the idea that people are, in virtue of being asked questions, personal questions about their doctors, chilled in the exercise of their constitutional rights. It's very strange.
Well, and what's obviously really going on here, the driving force behind this is gun rights groups that want to prevent these conversations from happening because they don't trust doctors to give information that is congenial to the gun rights group's ideological position on gun ownership. And that's why this runs smack in to the First Amendment, because what they're trying to do is prevent these types of conversations.
Right. Speech that we don't like and would rather not hear. And that is a core First Amendment concern. And the court, despite giving lip service to that concern and treating this as a content-based speech restriction, really does not engage in the kind of searching scrutiny that you're supposed to see under the highest standard of review in constitutional cases.
The one person who does get this, though, is Judge Wilson, who has now issued three dissents in this case, in the first opinion, the second opinion. In the third opinion, his dissent is only a single page because his dissents in the previous cases are so long. And he basically just says, you know, I reiterate everything I said in the original opinions about how this can't possibly satisfy First Amendment scrutiny. You know, this is procedurally a very unusual case. What has happened is after the appellants initially lost, they petitioned for rehearing en banc. The panel has, on its own initiative, reissued its opinion twice, but that initial en banc petition has been pending now for over 16 months. So it's very likely that this is going to get, I think, further review from the 11th Circuit. And if that doesn't happen, there's a very good chance this will go up to the Supreme Court. And I think the Supreme Court should take this case.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Evan.
So this case involves alcohol regulations in Indiana. The state of Indiana has a regulatory scheme under which packaged liquor stores are permitted to sell cold packaged beer, but grocery and convenience stores are not. And the question is two things. Does Indiana's power pursuant to the 21st Amendment, which repealed prohibition but allowed states to set their own alcohol laws, essentially give Indiana carte blanche to pass whatever alcohol regulations it would like? It's the first question. Second of all, it's an equal protection question, whether the state is drawing irrational distinctions by allowing packaged liquor stores to sell cold packaged beer, but grocery store and convenience stores not to.
Yeah, this is one of those opinions where it really seems like the court is kind of giving with one hand and taking away with the other hand, because its analysis of the 21st Amendment issue is actually very good. And it harkens back to a case called Granholm versus Heald that the Institute for Justice was involved in about the interstate shipment of wine. In that case, the court said that states can't favor in-state shippers of wine as opposed to out-of-state shippers of wine, that violates the Dormant Commerce Clause, and the 21st Amendment doesn't override the Commerce Clause. So this sort of builds on that and says also the 21st Amendment doesn't override the Equal Protection Clause. And that's a great opinion. But then when it gets to its equal protection analysis, basically everything falls apart.
Let's talk about the regulatory scheme a little bit more. So convenience stores are allowed to sell alcohol, just not cold beer.
Yeah, they can sell chilled drinks, even with higher alcohol content than beer, like wine coolers. And they can already sell beer. They just can't sell cold beer. And the argument is that because kids are going to be going into these stores, and generally you want to create an environment in which there aren't bottom line here is that this is kind of sin regulation. There are certain things that are icky, and we don't want them in places where a lot of people in the community are. So we put them or we shift them to places where only people who are over 21 go.
Paul, the state says that this regulatory scheme protects against underage drinking. What's their evidence for that claim? And did the court ask them for any evidence?
Well, I mean, because this is a rational basis case, the government doesn't have to produce any evidence in order to prevail. And as Evan mentioned, grocery stores are allowed to sell things like wine coolers, which I don't, you know, we all went to high school, and I remember a lot of people enjoyed drinking wine coolers. So I don't know that there's any evidence, and there's certainly no reason to believe that this law does a lot to discourage underage kids from drinking.
Evan, so what's the main takeaway from this case?
The takeaway here is, despite saying that Indiana doesn't have an absolute power to regulate alcohol in any way that they want, effectively Indiana can regulate alcohol in any way that they want. The plaintiffs point out numerous inconsistencies in the way that the state has approached this purportedly grave public health, public morality issue, and yet the court doesn't take them seriously. It says this mode of argument, that is, rational argument, doesn't suffice under rational basis review. It's pure judicial abdication, and it's something we all too often see in rational basis cases.
Okay, let's move on to the last case. Paul.
Well, so this case is a nice change of pace from the previous one because it's a case where the court actually did engage with the facts and come to what I think is a pretty reasonable conclusion. The case is called United States versus Williams, and it's a Fourth Amendment traffic stop case involving the suppression of evidence. These two cars were driving down I-85. They were pulled over by the police, and during the traffic stop, the police did a breathalyzer test of one of the drivers. They found that he had not set off the breathalyzer test. He was okay to drive. And then at the end of that, when they gave him a warning for speeding, they said, hey, do you mind if we search your car? And this is sort of a common thing. The police try to manufacture consent to search your car. The driver said, no, you can't search my car. And so after that, they did a drug dog sniff of the car. The dog alerted to the trunk. They opened the trunk and they found crack cocaine. So the fight was whether, is this evidence admissible under the facts of this case? Did the police have a reasonable suspicion for extending the search past the initial warning for speeding?
And the Supreme Court recently touched on the issue of prolonging a stop, Evan.
Yes, they did. They specifically said that you can't prolong a stop to bring a drug dog by to sniff a car if you don't have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or evidence of a crime. So in this case, the core question boils down to whether there was reasonable suspicion based on the factors that that the officers identified to bring the drug dog by.
And what were those factors?
The defendants were traveling in a rental car. The defendants were traveling on a known drug corridor at 12:37 a.m. And there were some inconsistencies in the guy's travel plan and, has a post office box that's not actually his home address.
Now, there was also originally a fifth justification that they put forward, which is that, remember I mentioned that there were two cars. And so the cars are being driven by this guy Williams and his brother. And what the police initially said was that the brother denied that he was traveling with Williams. And so when the defendant moved to suppress the evidence, the judge pointed to that and said, oh, well, that's really suspicious that he would deny that they're traveling together. As it turns out, that just wasn't true. And it was flatly contradicted by dash cam footage from the cops that was not turned over until months after that initial suppression hearing. And the only explanation for this inconsistency, the cop just said, well, I was wrong. So then it goes back and it's analyzed just on these four factors that Evan has mentioned.
Right. And let's be honest about what happened here. The police didn't engage in this careful consideration of whether they had all of the indicia of reasonable suspicion before they brought the drug dog by. They just brought the drug dog by because they could, and the drug dog was a couple of minutes away. And the bottom line here and the question that the court has to confront is whether somebody's an officer's inchoate, inarticulate hunch that a guy is suspicious is enough to justify searching his vehicle.
The district court said that it was, and now we have an engaged decision from the Fourth Circuit, which says that it's not.
Yeah, the Fourth Circuit did a really admirable job of looking at the four factors that the cops articulated in this case, both individually and collectively, and just pointing out that there was no there, and that a lot of it really boils down to the cops just using certain buzzwords. So, you know, they said that the car was driving down a known drug corridor. Well, drug corridor is really just a synonym for interstate highway. And as the court points out, the interstate highway system is the most efficient way to drive between two cities in the United States, and the overwhelming majority of people driving down interstates are not drug couriers. So the mere fact that someone's on the interstate isn't evidence that they're transporting drugs. And there's similar things about the time of night when they were driving.
The rental car, the fact that he has a rental car.
That's right. Most people who have rental cars are not criminals. The mere fact that he was going to extend the amount of time when he was renting the car does not suggest that he is a criminal. So instead of relying, as Evan said, on these kind of inchoate hunches that the police had, they just said, look, nothing that you've pointed to gives us any reason to believe that you could extend this traffic stop. And there's no de minimis exception. Once you're done with the traffic, you know, the warning for speeding, unless you have reasonable suspicion, you have to let that person go. So it's a very good ruling from the Fourth Circuit and kind of a nice continuation of the trend that the Supreme Court started with the Rodriguez case.
Okay, well, I think it would be unreasonable to extend this podcast any further. As always, thanks for listening. For more judicial engagement, be sure to follow Paul and Evan on Twitter. Their handles are at Paul M. Sherman and at Evan Burnick. And so until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, nagging you to get engaged.